Welcome back to Deep Thoughts, ladies and gentlemen. Today, I'm going to re-record an episode that I had recorded once before. And I realized in the middle of it, I got through it. It probably wasn't the worst thing. But I just felt like I hadn't sorted out my thoughts first. And so then I went ahead and had some conversations with some extremely close friends of mine, of which I know their opinions are very seasoned, and I could trust, you know, sort of their instincts. And as you can see, this is called losing adulthood. There's several ways I can start this out, but I just want to get right to the point really, really quickly. It used to be that becoming an adult was something that you looked forward to. And sadly, it has been translated incorrectly to simply getting old, having years on your driver's license, maybe a wrinkle, maybe a gray hair, maybe so many kids, so many grandkids, so many bills, so much debt. But it's seldom ever in the 21st century gets equated to a level of maturity and behavior. And I will say that the current, you know, corona thing has really revealed in my own personal circles, those who are mature and those who are extremely immature. And really, it doesn't have any correlation with age. And we know there's a bit of that in all cases, in all time frames, right? It's always been that way. There's always someone, you know, who's older, who's acting like a child, and someone who's a child is acting older. But what I'm talking about is, you know, when I grew up, it wasn't hard to find adults. It just happened, you know. In fact, it happened a lot earlier than it does right now. But as well, you know, the vanity of staying physically younger gets more and more absurd with time. I think we did just come out of a really crazy phase where during the 80s and 90s, women got, you know, implants of silicone, which then caused massive damage to their bodies if they ever had a rupture. So now they use saline and that sort of thing. But, you know, the Botox shots, the lip injections, the plastic surgery comes and goes. I think we're sort of on a downward curve on that. Botox can, I think, be done by some folks at a more casual state, such that you can do it and look very, very normal. Some folks go nuts with it and they just look like zombies. But the permanent damage, you know, butt implants, these guys getting pec implants, the guys in Russia injecting their arms with, I don't even know I forgot what it is, but, you know, physically destroying their bodies to the point where, you know, they might have to have their arms amputated. I mean, it's just insane. And I think it's because we get so inundated with other people's opinions about what we're supposed to be that we lose track of ourselves completely. You know, it's almost like you're standing in a subway, but you didn't know you were. And you were just standing there totally dealing with yourself, dealing with age, dealing with everything, learning things, translating knowledge into wisdom. And all of a sudden the train comes by and it's this, you know, it's all painted up beautifully and it's got all kinds of pictures of people that are perfect. And, you know, the door's open, and if you're a girl and you like boys, then there's a bunch of hot guys telling you to come on, and then it's the opposite. If you like girls, they're waving you in, and then you just kind of dumbfoundingly go in because it looks like it's better in there, and then they haul ass to the next dimension, which is insanity, and you lose yourself. You're back there at the original starting point, you know? One thing I find interesting in conversations as of the 21st century, for sure, because I crossed 30 in the year 2000, is that people tend to gravitate in conversation with other people based on their level of maturity. And the more you're sort of in the medium to low, you can find quite a few people to have a conversation with. But you find out at the end of the conversation, you really didn't talk about anything. And that's obviously none of you guys who are hardcore listeners. You're probably here because we have been through that. And it's not like we're better than anyone else. It's just we're at a higher level of complexity with what we want to talk about. Some things are very existential and spiritual and interesting, ghosts and physics and that kind of thing. What's the shape of the world? Those kind of neat topics. But now we're in a kind of a state of emergency, or at least we're being told we're in a state of emergency. And it's really up to the adults to guide us through these phases. You know, I've said it several times, and I've heard other people say it as well. One of the reasons why many of us think that people hate Donald Trump is that when you go into the life of someone who very much dislikes him, they have some authority figure in their life that abused them. And so having a stern father figure run the country for the very first time since I don't even know when, maybe Kennedy was a father figure, maybe. I think we can say that Lincoln was most likely a father figure. Andrew Jackson was a father figure. There's this rejection of Trump because it's like, I want the, you know, little kids to run the country, which means anything goes. Anything goes. And there's several different, Star Treks. There's one back in the 60s where Captain Kirk found a planet that was being run by kids. You know, ranging from about 16 down to like 6. Because a spaceship crashed on that planet and eventually all the adults died. And so the little kids had to just take over. And it was this weird Peter Pan world. And so Captain Kirk was there trying to reason with the oldest boy to get him to, you know, let him help them. And boy, did they just fuss and fuss, didn't they? And that episode of Star Trek is an absolute mirror image, or I should say direct copy, clone of what America is dealing with in these last 3 years. My buddy Robert Llewellyn in the UK, he used to have a vlog before he did his Fully Charged show. Prior to that, the carpool show, where he invented carpooling as a television show. He's the OG dude who made that format happen. But he made an episode once, and he started off the episode by simply saying, just a little vlog, he said, you know, one of my listeners said, what do you think about getting old? And at first he said, well, you know, it doesn't impact my acting career because I play a robot on Red Dwarf, so I get to wear a mask. But he said, you know what? He goes, when I was young, I looked up to those that were older than me. They were safe, wise folks. And even if they had to pass out some discipline in his direction, he realized that they were right and he was wrong and he needed to behave. He needed to learn something. And so he said, you know, he's probably about mid-50s, I think, when he did this. He looked at his face in the camera and he's like, you know, I like my wrinkles. He goes, I like my gray hair. I like losing my hair. He doesn't want to be unhealthy in terms of gaining weight or anything. He's pretty much the same size dude all the time. But he went on and on. He's one of the most articulate, amazing human beings out there. After he was done with that vlog, he changed my life forever. Because I was like, yeah, that is cool. You know, I got long hair right now. I've had long hair since 2009. Okay. I didn't have long hair before then. It was just something I did. I was running my game company. I guess it's probably 2007, to be honest. I just stopped cutting my hair and it just kept getting longer and longer. And I finally felt like it was the way I feel inside. And I'm sort of upset with myself that I didn't do it way, way earlier as a young kid. But eventually, my hair will recede. It'll do whatever. I'm going to cut it off and that'll be it. It'll be over. I'll never have long hair again. And then I will look much, much older. Okay. I'm going to be much, much older too. So it's okay. It's all right, man. Now, some folks really dig it, like my buddy Robert. I've told you guys, and again, I'm going to hit a little bit of the cosmetic side of things because I think that feeds into our sort of rejection of becoming more stoic and mature. Because we feel like, some people feel like this, that if we were ever to grow up and ever to lose the bouncy, youthful self, that we will automatically age 100 years physically, and boy, we'll just be rejected by society because we're so old. None of that's true. None of that's true. You can be as fun-spirited as possible, as humanly possible, I should say, for yourself, and still be looking like Father Time, you know? But I went back to my high school reunion last time, and I've said this a couple times for the hardcore listeners, but I noticed that a few of us look like we've barely aged. And some of us look like we had aged 10, 20 years beyond everyone else. Now, one of them was that the folks that smoked cigarettes, which again are nothing like cigars at all, automatic 10 years added to their life. Consequently, the strange thing was the folks that smoked cigarettes, a lot of them didn't have teeth. And that was pretty unique. It's pretty rare for people in my hometown not to have teeth, but there's a few stragglers that didn't have teeth. But the ones that really looked old, I should say older, and they don't have any problem with what I'm about to say, so this is no criticism whatsoever, but it's just an interesting scientific thing that relates to probably the neural peptides that are well documented in the movie What the Bleep Do We Know. But they would sit around and talk about being old. They'd pat their belly, literally lean back, you know, pat their belly, that kind of thing. You know, their belly is table muscle and all that kind of stuff. But they had more sayings about being old than anyone I know. I mean, you know, we're all about, I guess they were about 48 when they were doing that. I graduated really young, so I was 47. But it was just fascinating seeing how their adaptation and acceptance and then professing their age really aged them a lot. It's very interesting. The difficulty in really trying to isolate what I'm trying to get at, and I know that most of you kind of feel it out, but it's important in the conversation to get to a point so maybe where we can enlighten each other with different thought processes about this whole thing. We are the most immature generation that has ever been in the United States of America, from every boomer all the way down to probably the millennials. I think the zoomers have shown an interest in being more stoic, and they're less social media, they're less video game. They're more about getting out in life, playing a guitar, reading a book. So I think the Zoomers, and I don't know what you call the ones that come after that, but they are a very interesting group of folks. And, you know, when I deal with my screenwriting friends, where we have to sit around and talk about the demographics that are out there and who wants what, we are definitely acknowledging the massive difference between the Zoomers and the Millennials, where we can lump Millennials, Gen X's together with slight changes in dress code and facial hair. Generally, the same product sells to both. The Boomers, you know, they're the first generation to come out of the post-World War II era, and it was a good era, even though they had the Korean War and nukes and stuff to worry about in the 50s. About 1958 and up, even though the Vietnam War was going, I think that that war kind of warmed up so slowly that we got, you know, Michael Jackson and Prince and just a bunch of amazing people. But the boomers, just to kind of give you a some of the stuff, some of the more interesting stories that I know from Hollywood, those of you who watch a lot of making of videos of your favorite movies, you'll know this is true. But I was very fortunate, I think because of my own maturity, to really befriend folks that were 20 to 25 years older than me and just become best friends, because I just know their past. They know their past. And so we're very compatible with appreciating film to that level or whatever. But most of you understand that, you know, all the movies made from 1975 to say 1990 are made out of boomers. And most of them, of which were massive hippies, took tremendous amounts of acid and saw the universe at a level that few have ever seen it. And of course, acid's got all this ridiculous myths about it. I mean, they take everything that heroin, cocaine does and then put it on acid. And it's like, if it's really acid, you're perfectly fine. The only bummer is if you have a lot of skeletons in the closet, the closet door is going to open. So make sure you're a balanced minded human being. And then you'll have an experience that will change you for the rest of your life. And it won't be like being drunk. You'll actually be sentiently there. And when you get out of it, you'll feel like you went to a museum. And every day that goes by after you take your first trip, which will be the best ever, my advice is to take as much as you can, quite frankly, on that first trip, and be with someone who knows what the hell was going on. Anyway, it'll just feel like, you know, it's 2 weeks since I went to the museum, 4 weeks since I went to the museum. It's not going to go away like a dream or anything like that, which is why a lot of people say you only need one trip, but you want to plan it and get your soul ready. But these individuals, by being raised by stoic parents, which is your pre-boomer parents, right? They had this amazing wisdom sort of imbued in them through sheer experience. Now, there was also this rebellious stage with rock and roll, especially, right, where they had rules, and the rules were actually serving them quite well. Get married, have a kid, get started before you're 22 years old. Have your kids when you're young, so your kids are really healthy. Plus, the women's bodies bounce right back because they were really young. Man, if you want to have 3 kids, you could have them done by the time you're 30. You bounce back. You either go to school, finish school, go to work, whatever you want to do as the lady, and it all worked out. But there was sort of this rebellious split in the United States, and I'm not sure about any other country, but like my parents never went the hippie route. But girlfriends of mine have parents that went the mega hippie route. Both sides sort of paid prices. When I got here to Los Angeles the second time, really got close to film, got into film, I started interviewing these guys about their experiences. You know, I'll just give you some for instances. There's two guys that, I guess Van Vliet and Cassidy, they're the two lightning drawing guys in Hollywood. They did the lightning in Star Wars. They did a lot of like saber work. They did the lightning that's in Tron when they got poked with the cattle prod thing. And so you sit and you interview these guys. Van Vliet, I mean, he went on with Spielberg into Indiana Jones stuff, and it's just tremendous. Richard Edlin, who I know fairly well, tons of Oscars. He's a camera designer. He's just an amazing dude. He did all your special effects for all those Star Wars movies. He was in San Francisco driving trolley cars just before he gets the job in San Rafael or wherever the Skywalker Ranch is. Which should tell you that you can be anything in the world and you can get to those amazing moments in your next job. You know, you're like driving a trolley car going, this is not what my life is supposed to be about. And then all of a sudden you're making a landmark movie in motion picture history, right? But even though these individuals were hippies at one point, and even though they took massive amounts of acid, I don't think any of them really played around with cocaine, or definitely not heroin. I don't know. Speed was usually like something you did just to stay awake while you were working. But I doubt that that had a lot of impact on these individuals. But they were able to take on the responsibility of making a feature film of a monumental size, Star Wars, 3-year production cycle. Now, of course, George Lucas had already done American Graffiti, THX-1138. So he was sort of the, you know, the thrust and the thread that brought it all together. Of course, other people worked on the film who had worked on several films before. But there was a lot of first-timers. I think Phil Tippett's first film was Star Wars. What's interesting now is that we tend to live our lives in two different ways. We either pioneer our lives because we have the maturity to understand what we're doing. We understand our goals. And if there is a void in how we can accomplish what we're trying to accomplish, we know how to go get the information. And then we get better, and we practice, and then we execute, right? All day today, for instance, I've been modeling a Star Trek Enterprise that I designed in 1997. And it's been in a side view, top view for 23 years. And I've always wanted to 3D model the thing. And so I didn't know if it would actually look good. I didn't know if it would work. And so I got into it. My Blender, a product I'm getting much better. I'm taking like 4 classes in that. And the classes are just upgrading me every single day. I watch one lesson. I'm like, oh my God, that's how I solved that problem. Oh yeah, this is great technique. Throw away destructive modeling, go to non-destructive modeling, all this other stuff. I've modeled this thing and it's just a prototype model, but my God, it works. It looks sexy as shit. Okay, that's what these guys did. Today, we obviously have massively talented people all over the world. Look at the Marvel movies. Look at writing on like Westworld season 1. I mean, there's some serious talent out there. But when you come out of like the Disneyland realm of the world and come down to like mortal human beings, this is where the reaction to mass media telling you statistics that aren't true, and then watching how people react. The adults calm everyone. The children exacerbate everyone. Try to like become important by usurping disasters. That's not maturity. That is a raving child that's screaming for help. My concern is this. We are in a moment in time which is unlike anything even my grandparents, I mean, maybe my grandparents who were the pre-boomer generation, they went through a good 10 years of depression, had all their gold confiscated, then they took part in a world war. And even though America didn't get involved in World War II as fast as history might make you feel, we got attacked in 1941. We fought a Pacific battle. It was much shorter than the Atlantic battle. But we didn't go over and start stepping on European soil until like the last year and a half or so of the war, right? Not even just been the last year, like 1944. But they went through all of that and then popped out and got a glory day situation, which usually led to the birth of all these kids, the boomers, the baby boomer generation. Now, as the world reconstituted out of the Depression and out of the World War II phase, we had adults at the helm. They built the little towns that I grew up in. And, you know, by the time that was going on, my town was probably just hitting about 100 years old. And so they had great people before them, literally build the town, build the streets, build the buildings, establish a bunch of businesses. And then as my grandparents' generation moved into the sockets, you know, it was like the old generation moves out, the next generation moves in. You still bought a car from an adult. You still got your services from adults. Today, it's sort of hit and miss, right? So like maybe every other person Maybe it's, you know, 3 out of 5 sort of ratio are adults, maybe. And then you have raving children running around, you know, blowing all their money, trying to impress people that don't exist. They can drink a ton of alcohol, smoke a bunch of dope, and maybe drive a fancy car. Nobody cares. So we're potentially, I know things look, you know, dark right now. I have all the confidence in the world our economy is going to bounce back. Literally, the word on the street is increasingly louder and louder that the Federal Reserve just got a knife right through its heart, which is the greatest news we could have ever heard in America. So there's a potential that by the end of the year, we're going to have our own currency again, backed by the U.S. Treasury, a nationalized bank. And the only people that have taught you that a nationalized bank is bad is the Federal Reserve, who's the competitor to such a concept. But let's say in a year or two, maybe even less, we gain control over not only America, but as soon as Europe sees what happens in America, you folks over there, you're going to riot like crazy. You're going to destroy the EU. You're going to rip down EU flags like, you know, Baghdad ripped down statues of Saddam Hussein. You're going to call this the Dark Ages 2.0, that you ever created the EU and that you ever joined it, that you bankrupt yourself, that you let your country get overrun by folks that have no respect for your culture, your religion, and your way of life. And you'll clean it up. I have no doubt you'll clean it up. Might be a little rough for some of those immigrants, but you're going to clean it up. Maybe you'll integrate them. Maybe you'll throw them out. I don't know. It's up to you, man. Over here, we have a pretty good mix right now. We can deal with everything that's here now. We're used to assimilating and all that kind of stuff, and perhaps your country does too. But what I'm concerned about is taking over for these corrupt individuals. There's an interesting thing happening in Africa right now, especially South Africa. And I've watched documentaries on it. I've watched interviews with native African individuals, not the imports from Europe. And many of these districts that are being sort of returned back to the natives that were, you know, some of them were really well kept, some of them weren't, but they're going to hell. I mean, these places are getting overrun by their own native folks, and they're just destroying the whole place. There's trash everywhere. People are, the gangs have moved in. I mean, it's not safe to be there anymore, even if you're 100% African. And that's what can happen if you're not mature enough to maintain what you found. And so we have to make sure in all corners of the world that if you can hear my voice, if you can repeat this to someone else, you know, we have to potentially, some of you might even become politicians at some point because there simply is no better choice. But even if you're going to cast a vote, it's important that you understand, well, what is a good candidate? I'm sure that the word maturity, refinement, some sort of chieftain synonym is in there somewhere. And that's just running the country. That's determining your foreign policy, your domestic policy, all the economics, all the environmental considerations. Because we have a lot of things to fix in all categories in America. You know, our minimum wage is completely screwed up, but doubling, more than doubling it is ridiculous, which is what they've nearly done here locally. So they're not doing anything logically because politicians are just schmoes half the time that just want a free paycheck. Some of them are extremely dedicated and they deserve to be elected. Children. I know Michael Jackson sang about it a lot, and maybe it's even sort of a cliche in your mind, but children are the future of the world. And if they're raised badly, it doesn't matter how much you have your act together, in one generation, the whole place can go to hell. And we know that the one commodity of this world that is in more dire straits than even food, meaning that there's more food than there is of this other thing, and the other thing is called education. The entire planet is drastically uneducated. Yes, there are nerds in every single culture. There's a brainiac African kid, brainiac Australian kid, American kid, Canadian kid, Chinese kid. There's brainiacs, but don't let that go to your head. Until you can look around and say, well, everyone's like that kid, then we got work to do. I always tell you on this show that, you know, one of the reasons why I created this show was because of the thing I said in probably the third or fourth episode, which was life does not come with a manual. You don't get a manual when you turn 18 to tell you how to be an adult, or 25, or when you have your first kid, or when you want to court someone or marry someone. We're out here in the wild, wild west. And you know what the manuals are in this world today? It's called advertising. And there's two types of advertising, isn't there? There's straight up, you're about to watch a commercial and you understand you're watching a promotional ad. Then there's the subliminal indoctrination. You're watching your favorite Star Trek show and they're telling you the ozone layer exists. Not only does it exist, there's a hole in it. And da 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 da. You watch Pacific Rim and you can tell in that little scene towards the third act where the guy starts talking about global warming and killing dinosaurs and all this other crap that, boy, just narrative injected right in there. Deep state Agenda 21 crap right in your film, just so that dude could get a little bit of money to pay for his film. Al Gore's movie, The Inconvenient Lie, is shown to kids since December 2006. As a mandatory viewing thing, such that they buy into all this carbon credit crap. You see, they're smart. The ruling class of the world, despite anyone's critique, they're getting shit done. Whether or not they're completely insane, which I don't think they are. I think they're just hubris, if nothing else. But they, if you were just to let the things go that are moving today, well, 97 to 99% of the world would be depopulated. We'd all be moved into these cities with these 5G towers eating up our entire DNA, giving us dizziness and headaches and the inability to sleep and concentrate and remember anything. Okay. You wouldn't be free. I mean, you would literally feel more surveyed and more controlled than the average prisoner in a private for profit prison in the United States of America. That's how smart they are. They got it all ready to go. There are really brilliant people out there designing robots at Boston Dynamics. Those robots, you are watching them create the fleet of people of virtual robots that are going to take over all law enforcement, probably for the first country that can afford it, replacing the military. And just brace yourself, man. You won't be able to yell at a robot giving you a ticket. You know, all those things where they try to appeal to the friendly face of a highway patrol person. Can I, you know, please don't give me a ticket. The robot's just going to be like, take your ticket. When you write a screenplay, they teach you that in order to take your protagonist and actually make them a hero, it's creating, you know, an intent with an obstruction. And then, like, they're trying to do something and it's not working. And so, like a MacGyver move, a hero makes decisions under pressure. And they make usually the right decision more often than the wrong decision. If they make the wrong decision, it is should be portrayed in your script as complete mistake. They're just trying to do their best and it's not working out. The blue wire, the green wire, not trying to blow everyone up in the room. They're just using what they have to make it work. I just watched a little 23-minute documentary about, it's made in 2007, and it's about gangs in South Auckland, New Zealand. And I don't know what the situation is now, but, you know, 10 years after we stopped all of our craziness in Los Angeles, these kids are worshiping the gangster mentality in Los Angeles. They'll even tell you to your face that's exactly what they're copying. And there was a little scene in the documentary where I guess this much older guy, probably in his mid-50s, he had his house broken into, some clothing stolen. He's a foster parent for this little boy who was headed towards getting in a gang, and he's now giving them a lot of alternatives, which is really cool. Hopefully the kid didn't end up in that situation. But the kid got freaked out, the little kid, because he's got someone in there. And so these kids who are probably between 15 and 18 are still walking around the town. They're still threatening this little 10-year-old kid. And so finally the 10-year-old kid came home one day during the filming of this documentary. He says, they're right there by the mall. That's one of them right there, one of them right there. And he points them out to this dude. So this dude calls the cops. He calls his own backup. And within 2 seconds, the old man is like right on top of this probably 16, 17-year-old kid. And first and foremost, because he was professional, but because he was a mature adult and a chieftain, Gene, he grabbed the back shirt of the kid and stopped him. He's probably 4 inches shorter than the kid. And the kid just freezes. Well, it's like when you grab a cat by its neck, man. The cat just goes, whoop, time to stop, right? But he lectures the kid, you know, asks him what the hell he thinks he was doing. Do you have my stuff? I want you to apologize to me. I want you to apologize to my son. I want you to go get the kid who's got my crap and bring it to my house. And, you know, it was one of these situations where in today's climate, that dude is like a rare being, because in today's environment, you got a parent who's had their house broken into, their child terrorized, stuff stolen from their house, and they find the kid. In Orange County, you'd probably get your face bashed in. Doesn't matter how young you are. The adult's going to tear you a new one, depending on how big you are, right? But this kid's a big kid, right? He's a big bully. But this dude showed complete compassion for the situation, because he's mentoring this kid at home, trying to keep him out of gangs. And so he knows that if he goes gangster on this punk, he's got to come home and tell the kid that that's what he did. And that's exactly what the kid would learn as the right thing to do. And he doesn't want that little 10-year-old to hear that story. And so the dude filming the documentary is like filming this pretty close, you know. And after it's all over, when they have an agreement, you go get my stuff, you go get the kid that has my stuff. I want you to bring it to my house. We're not going to have any problems, but I want you to apologize to me. He's basically saying, I want you to grow up. I want you to understand this is not right. And I'm giving you a break, and you know I'm giving you a break, because I could haul your ass to the cops. I could haul you to your parents, whatever, right? And the guy filming it looks at the guy and he says, that took an amazing amount of restraint, didn't it? And he's like, yeah, man. He goes, I am really pumped up right now. He goes, I can just tell you, I want to just beat the kid up, but I know that that's just going to be more of what I don't like about this world, and I'll be part of the problem. That's a chieftain. That's a hero making a much better decision under pressure, not to be violent, not to return the favor that he gave the family. And the kid was pretty cool. I mean, the kid caved. You could hear his voice was scared. And it's like my sociology teacher in high school always told us, he says, look, he goes, if you had a 6'4", 18-year-old fighting a 5'8", 40-year-old, he goes, as long as both of them know how to fight, he goes, I will put all my money on the 48-year-old or 40-year-old or whatever any day. And we're all looking at him kind of funny. We're like, well, the other kid's bigger. And he goes, yeah, but confidence is everything. And, you know, that's exactly what was on camera in this little documentary. You know, we have people, and this is a big subject of discussion in America. It's probably happening in your district too, but America, you know, we do have our kind of cowboy mentality. It isn't just a complete rumor. There's a branch in my cigar right there. Holy hell. But right now, for instance, we have a lot of very corrupt politicians, intelligence agents, former presidents, former secretaries of state, very, very corrupt people, plus all of their hangers-on IT companies that are very cabalish. And, you know, when we start seeing the damage that they're doing to something that took hundreds of years to get to where it is today, and it's everything we could do to hold it together just with the normal chaos of the world, and then, you know, within a 15-year period, we have an infiltrator after infiltrator come through the country and treat it like a dirty rag. It's very easy as a United States citizen to say, look, these people are treasonistic individuals. They've tried to destroy the republic, the dream of freedom. Freedom to all things. Freedom to, you know, worship the religion that you have. Freedom to procreate up to a reasonable level, right? And so we can get very, very angry at those individuals and even say things off the cuff that it's very, you know, they should be, you know, hanging from the gallows or, you know, whatever. And, you know, it's that formula from The Walking Dead, the Rick formula. Actually had someone disagree with me in the comments, which I thought was sort of cool. Now, I'm going to spoil season 2 of Walking Dead to make this point. But if you haven't seen a show that's dead, then I don't think you're probably likely to watch this. But it won't ruin the show for you in the long run. But there's two cops at the beginning of the show when the world is normal. And I think it's Shane and Rick. And they're buddies. They're partners. They ride around in a cop car. Then the apocalypse happens. This virus or whatever it was that turns people into zombies, you know, hits the streets. Everybody starts either dying or turning into zombies or whatever. And it goes for 2 seasons. I think it's 2. Where Shane starts to get the attitude that probably I would have, which is, look, the world just went to shit and we can't put this back in a bottle. Because these people who are zombies are never going to be cured of being zombies. They're just zombies. And so until we can lob all their heads off and live in peace, we're going to be losing people left and right. And during that time, the humans that are still around are going to be feral. They're going to be starving to death. They're going to rob and kill to survive. There's no more code of ethics anymore in mankind. And they had seen this 100% in their experience in the first 2 seasons. Just nearly dying several times, losing part of their clan to zombie attacks and all that stuff. But now Rick was the actual sheriff of the town. And so his whole thing is to keep the peace, to be the hero, to make those tough decisions under pressure, and to make sure we don't lose our humanity is sort of where he felt in the spectrum of things. So at the very end of season 2, it really came down to it came down to a little bit more in that he thought Shane was, Shane started sleeping with his wife because they thought he was dead. And then he said, I'm really sorry, dude. I thought you were dead. We thought you were dead. We were told you were dead. And, so we just kind of, you know, comforted each other. And now that you're back, hey, it's totally cool, man. I won't touch her. So there's a bit of that backstory behind there too, but there's a showdown in a field. I think kind of during the day. And it really came down to Rick's philosophy versus Shane's philosophy. And Rick said, you know, your philosophy is going to get us killed because you're going to turn us into those feral beings. And we're going to just be always at war with people. And eventually my son's going to get killed. And so I need to make sure that we don't fall down that realm, that we take the high road. And this will be over before you know it, meaning all the zombies will be dead. And then we'll rebuild society and we won't be a bunch of, you know, Mad Max people trying to rebuild society. will just be heavily injured normal people. And so they had a showdown in the field, and Rick killed Shane. And over the course of the rest of the show, probably I would say before season 7 started, Rick learned that Shane was right. Not that he was happy that Shane was right. It just really got down to the point where they had lost so many people that Rick was like, yeah, you know what? If we don't turn into Shane's philosophy, then we're all dead. And Rick became so much worse than Shane ever was, which is part of the brilliant part of the writing. That archetype for me is huge as we face this new epoch, right? Because the thing is we're getting incredibly educated about how the world works, but, you know, I would say that the two most important groups of people that we can educate right now, and they are self-educating quite well today. It was much tougher 15 years ago. But the military is our number one priority to educate. If you have family members in military, you've got to figure out how fast they can digest this information, figure out if they're already doing it, and then you feed them the most prime rib, you know, filet mignon information of the best source. Don't give them frilly, weird crap. Don't tell them that crazy loose theories are true. You could present it to them and say, man, we're hearing this on the street. But the number one thing is that every military person in the world has to believe in common law over anything that they might be told to do. Same goes for the second tier, which is our police officers. Now, it depends on, you know, there's a big difference between military folks and police officers, depending on how the military has been deployed. If the military is at home, and believe me, this is one of the reasons why they love to keep wars going forever. The military understands that if your citizens are at home, then they have a level of appreciation for life that the military does not want them to have, at least the previous command. So keeping your sons and daughters over in the Middle East for 3 tours or whatever means that they have no idea what it's like to be in society. They become war creatures and they become damn good at it, right? And so when they are told to seize weapons out of a person's house, you may actually have a more apt person to follow commands because they have been so disembodied from their true family unit that they don't know anything else. But police officers are constantly dealing with domestic violence issues. And I will say, having written, you know, a number of scripts with police officers in them and having to interview them, they're the most down-to-earth people on planet Earth. And one of the things that I can just tell you without asking them directly is when they find out that you're a good person, that they would most likely never, ever be called to your house unless you have an emergency, health emergency or something. You can just see them relax and just tell you anything you want to know. Because a lot of police officers, you know, they're just lied to constantly. Did you do that? No. You know, they got a fucking knife through their head and they're like, did you hurt your wife? No. You know, she's got a crowbar through her chest. You know, it's like, so they see a lot of it, but that's our cornerstone in the United States, at least, to make sure that crazy shit doesn't happen. I'm a little frightened that England has somehow been able to breed, I think, fairly intelligent human beings that will violate your civil rights in the name of the government. You know, when you posted a poo-poo comment on Facebook and these motherfuckers will show up to your front door. Hey, you know, what did you do that thing for? What are you talking about? It's freedom of speech, right? Don't we have freedom of speech in England? Oh, I guess not. I didn't incite violence. I didn't tell you to kill anybody. I just was expressing myself and I disagree. I'll tell you what, if it wasn't for live streaming on telephones, I think there'd be a lot more people in Europe in jail. But they start the live stream before they open the door, then they hold it up and they go, my Facebook page, he goes, I got like 5 views. is filming you right now. So say what you got to say. And boy, their demeanor, I've seen it, man. It changes. But then you're like, what are they doing here in the first place? How did they talk themselves into it? And, you know, it's funny. I'm going to put this in right here as we kind of mulch what it means to be mature and to have a little bit of reserve in our system before we act. I've said this before, but, you know, in America, the big thing that I think, especially when I worked with my friends from England, I worked for a company that was founded in England for three or four years, in two different runs. And then, of course, I've got some friends over there as well. But the big difference between conversating with someone who's natively from there to hear at least the professional sector of things, you might be able to quote a, you know, an area that doesn't do this, but is that they seem to think before they speak. I've mentioned this once before. But America is all about this land of, you know, your mouth and your brain are just 100% connected. You know, as soon as you form a thought, the syllables start coming out of your mouth, right? There's no, let's think and think about this. Well, if I said that, they'd have this emotion. If I said that, they'd have this emotion. I want the best emotion in the room. So maybe I won't say either one and I'll come up with a third one. That just, or maybe I just shut up. You know, maybe I don't even need to say anything. One of those kind of moments, right? Because the United States is bred to be reactionary, to be as quick with the mouth as the brain translates thoughts into other thoughts, we don't benefit much from the concept. That is, there's two sides to every coin. So in America, because we're so quick with our mouths, we don't benefit from the concept that there's two sides to every story. You know, two sides to the coin, as they used to say, right? And so there is probably, you know, more domestic violence. There's more business disputes. There's more conflict because the people that are the authoritative people that need to act. And this is where I actually really, really respect the police officers, at least that I'm exposed to, because they come in, they hear one person throw down their story. Well, he did this, he did, she did that. And then all of a sudden they, okay, well, you sit right there and I'm going to put you in my car if you're totally nuts. And they go off and get the other person's story. And then they start pushing the two stories together, determining what's most likely to have been true, whether or not both of them are lying, one of them's telling the truth, whatever. The observable facts. And they act. They're trained to do that. If only the rest of us would do it, you know? I've always thought that life, well, I shouldn't say always, but as I grew up, I finally figured out, you know, probably in my 20s, as I started to see the delta between being, you know, an adolescent, I guess I could say, you know, just every decade of life, I should probably put it that way. So 1 through 10, 10 through 20, 20 through 30. And then every stage of life that it seems to occur to us in each one of those realms. You know, some people marry in their 20s, some people marry in their 30s, but you're single with your family as a child. Everything's taken care of you pretty much. You got to go to school, brush your teeth and comb your hair sort of thing. And then as you start to approach the end of high school, you know, you got to get some type of career together, whether you're going to go to college or not. Then you jump into society. Eventually, you find someone you want to spend the rest of your life with. Maybe you have a family, maybe you don't. But if you do, then you become a parent. And then you have about 18 years of your youngest child before you're going to have any reprieve. And then maybe you got to earn the money to put them through college. Then they have kids eventually. You become a grandparent. And then usually, if you live a normal life, your kids, at least your oldest, will have a child that has a child. And you'll have four generations alive just before you pass away, which is always fun. We actually had that happen on my mom's side because her parents were 10 years younger than my dad's side. So we have a fourth generation picture. It's pretty cool. But each one of those realms offered a beautiful full spectrum experience being a parent's a full spectrum experience, from being a parent of a young child versus a teenager versus an adult. Everything changes over time. A lot of times grandparents get to watch the grandkids, and so you get kids back in your house, but now you're not totally responsible for them. You're just a little bit responsible for them. That's cool. And then, even though we die, and it happens, right? Then it gets blamed on Corona, of course. Even though we do die at some point, you're not dying, right? Your body dies, right? I'm really starting to think that we hang on to life a little too much as human beings. Like, we pretend like this is it. Now, I think that, you know, 100% you should give every human life, or every life that you ever have, your all. Even if you came back as a bear, do the best bear routine you possibly can. But definitely as a sentient human being, keep going, keep getting better. Try to do something you haven't done before, or do it again and do it better. Make better decisions the next time you come around. I guarantee you that whatever state you're in when you pass away, the next state you're going to experience is one of complete comfort. No more pain. One of the things that bothered me when I was a kid, and you tell me your thoughts on this particular one, because I would love to hear, because it's something I never hear discussed, which is that when I was, this is probably about 7, 8, 9, somewhere in there, I learned that old rule that you never ask a woman how old she is. And it's usually, I guess, over 40 is where it kind of starts. And it was this weird vanity that made asking that question suddenly forbidden, even though I'm a child. And I don't know. You know, I'm trying to piece together what we look like when we get older. I am not going up to my grandmother and going, "You are old." You know, if I were to say that, I would just be thinking you're older than me. But, you know, when I was a kid, it was like, okay, well, Dad, how old are you? I look at his face and I go, okay, that's maybe what I'll look like when I'm his age, 30, whatever, 35, whatever. But as I get older, I thought, what a crock that we allowed this ridiculous routine to start. That was, you don't say how old you are, out of straight, pure narcissistic vanity. And, you know, it's only with the females. Guys didn't care. But I guess the whole idea was, of course, that one woman might age more in appearance than another woman. Now, the woman who ages more might have 5 kids, for God's sakes. She is birthed into this world, human life, while the one that looks younger has never had a child. All right, maybe one of the people have had a harder life and one of them had an easier life. And we're supposed to conceal that which creates us. That's what makes us who we are. And I think that that's sort of the little thread in the sweater that if you pull it out, supposedly society unravels. Oh my God, he found out how old I was. Wasn't it Zsa Zsa Gabor? She always lied about how old she was. Why? Why? Seriously, the woman looks fantastic. In fact, the older she was in real life, for how she looked, it was a total success story. I saw this old movie, and it was like, had luck in its name, but it was Betty Davis. Betty Davis, who was obviously known for being one of the most beautiful women in Hollywood. Very eccentric looking. She had these amazing eyes, right? But she did this movie, I think in the early 60s, I'm pretty sure, where she played a woman who was a street lady. And here's a woman who was used to being, you know, just fawned over. But I saw her allow herself to not only be on camera with absolutely no makeup. I think they put more freckles on her face. They put this horrible wig on her head, or at least I'm pretty sure it was a wig, but they was ratted up gray hair thing. I mean, it was like literally she was a street woman, like a homeless person who sold apples. And the apple gave this nightclub owner some good luck in his mind. And eventually, it's one of the best movies you've ever seen in your life. If you haven't seen it, go look it up. It's on one of those like Turner Network sort of things. But eventually, they have to pretend for her daughter who lives in Europe, who's going to come to visit her in America. She has been lying to her daughter the entire time that she is nobility and that she knows everybody in the town. And so now this gangster, because he needs the apple, does her a favor because his girlfriend loves the old lady and is very empathetic, and he's not very empathetic. And so he agrees to throw the biggest party ever and to fake all of the dignitaries that she says she knows. And they do this makeover on her because he's wealthy and the girlfriend has like everything, right? The hair, the makeup, and everything. And she goes off into the room, a homeless person. And then, of course, she's Betty Davis, even though she's older. She comes in the room after that and she is utterly transformed. And it's an amazing thing. And when I saw that, I remember her being on What's My Line probably two or three times. And I think at one point, someone asked the question with the blindfold on how old she was. And of course, the audience laughed because you don't ask women that question. And I think at some point she answered it or something like that. But she managed to either not build up that weird narcissistic barrier, or she got over it. And for me, that makes her bigger than everybody else. When I first started working with the British company in the early 90s, there was a lot I didn't know. It was almost everything I didn't know about England. But they told me very quickly, like my boss and stuff was trying, because they would come over and visit, like the founder would come over and visit. And I was one of the lead engineers at one point. And so they kind of briefed me on how to talk to him. And they talked so quiet, I could barely understand the thing they were saying. You know, I mean, I would sit 3 feet away from the founder and he'd talk to me. And I'm sitting there, I'm really young. I have bionic hearing and I'm going, I have to ask you what you just said, you know. But one of the things that I learned, and I don't think it's that way as much anymore because America has infected England. Please correct me if I'm wrong. I've talked to Llewellyn at length about this. But that used to be that professors in academia were the superstars in England. And then it switched to the celebrities. And from what he's told me, I believe, was that, you know, the Beatles were able to come and go. And even the Rolling Stones were able to come and go. And the Who were able to come and go. And they were in the old era. And so they can walk around the streets and people won't bother them. And he told me this interesting story that one of the keyboard player from The Who passed away. He happened to live in the same neighborhood as Robert Llewellyn. It's like a modest gated neighborhood, but nothing that insane. I'm just quoting him. But he goes, I looked out my window and he goes, I'm watching like Robert Daltrey, Mick Jagger, and like Keith Richards walking up the street. Just talking to each other, which must have been a surreal moment, man. And because they're getting ready for the services that day. And he goes, no one's bothering them. Because it is a gated neighborhood, but there are young people and kids around, but no one touched them. And then he goes, because he's Crichton on Red Dwarf, which is a comedy that's been running since 1988, still goes to this day, as I understand it. But he says, I had to leave the house that day to go down into the grocery store to get some, you know, milk and things for the family. And he goes, I get mauled at the grocery store. And he goes, compared to these other guys who are in town, he goes, I'm nobody. You know, he goes, but I'm getting mauled because I'm in that next generation of kids where the celebrities are more important than the knowledgeable people of the world. And I think that as we're coming to a close in this episode, the big difference that I see in the transformation of my own experience in life is that during the 70s as a kid, I definitely saw a massive transformation from you own quality items that are the essentials of life. You have a relatively nice house. You have a nice car, but nothing insane. You wear nice clothes, but nothing insane. And that was fine. That's why everyone had money to go on vacations to pay for kids' colleges and that kind of thing. We also had a single income household, so I was about 7 years old. But then the advertising got insane. And not, I mean, advertising's always existed, you know, but I mean, I have invested a lot of time in watching advertising from the 40s, 50s, and 60s. And even though there were a lot of crazy items for sale, there wasn't this, you know, ridiculous go well beyond your means to pay for something and buy it, you know. But today we're not satisfied with the basics anymore. There has to be something that you own that is eccentric, expensive, impressive. You have to have one of them. If you can own two of them, you know, it's like you keep going and going and going. Think about someone who, you know, I'm a big Apple guy, Apple computer guy. You know, again, I'm a huge Apple dude, right? But I've started to move over to Windows. I've definitely gotten out of the ridiculous iPhone thing. And now it's a bona fide, you know, crappy product line. The only thing they make that isn't complete trash, in my opinion, for the money, would be the iPad and perhaps the iMac. Those two things are fairly affordable. But even the iMac now, I priced one out fully loaded. It's $4,000. Okay. You know what kind of Windows machine you could build with that kind of money? You could buy a $1,000 video card and still have the fastest of all things on planet Earth in a PC. It's ridiculous. But that's a brand now that costs more than all the other brands, does not have the equal speed of the competition. It looks cooler. But they do, you know, making, you know, shaping aluminum and glass to look cool. It doesn't cost you more money for the raw materials necessarily. The competing products are made of the same materials and they cost, you know, half the price, run at maximum speed. I've said this 100 times on the show, but this is a good place to repeat this. You have to know that all my friends that are extremely wealthy either never got into this buying material objects to create something valuable in life because they're creative people. What's more important to them is they create the next album that's awesome, the next movie that's awesome, or something else they create. But I have been in several country clubs that are very popular, very difficult to get into, smoke lounges full of, you know, outside there must be, without a doubt, you know, anywhere from $2 to $5 million in cars, and there's only 10 cars outside. And when I go inside and I listen to the people that own these vehicles, they're not that creative. And so for them, that's all they have. So, and then they're very smart people. They make money. Not all of them are trust fund kids. But it's sort of like you put that in place of something else that would be more rewarding to your soul. You know, I grew up my whole life not realizing how wealthy my grandparents were on my mom's side. But now I look back and it's like my grandfather, he owns an old New Yorker, I think it's what it was, and a Dodge Omni, like two really basic vehicles. The dude could have had a Mercedes. He could have had whatever he wanted, but he didn't. And the cool thing was the house they lived in had shag carpet. We had two rooms with like orange shag carpet. You actually went to the house and they would assign you your room by the color of the carpet. You're going to stay in the blue room downstairs. Oh, okay. Blue shag carpet downstairs. You're in the orange room upstairs. Oh, okay. You're in the orange room downstairs. You're in the brown rooms downstairs. It's kind of damp and crazy. It's where I grew up from my 17th year. It was kind of musty down there. They didn't have to have that kind of house. They could have totally had a house built from scratch and make it amazing. But what was important was the kids who grew up there were now able to come back home and visit their parents at a house that they grew up in. And so there's all this nostalgia at that house. You know, it's not owned by us anymore. But if I were able to go there, depending on how much they've either changed the place or left it alone, I know that if I went into one of the bathrooms and just took a shower, just brushed my teeth, I would relive, you know, God, 30 years of my entire life being in those homes. It was interesting. Think about the world being freed up from all of this chaos that we are now experiencing. Think about the world ejecting all of these evil people. And then we have to go in there and repair the damage that they have done. You know, 800,000 children a year disappear on planet Earth. 800,000. And even if you want to say, well, some of those kids are runaways, all right, let's give you an absurd runaway percentage, which is not true. It's way too high. 50% are all runaways. I've looked at statistics before. When Jeb Bush was losing 1,200 kids a year in Florida, the statistics were more like 20 to 30% were runaways, because the other percentage is so young, they have no means of running away. They're like a 10-year-old or an 8-year-old, right? They don't get that far. These kids are disappearing for reasons that we don't have to necessarily discuss on this episode. Many of you know they don't go to good places. I would say out of 800,000, 20% are probably dead by the end of the year because of where they end up going or where they get taken to. That's a lot of damage. That's a lot of damaged souls for anyone who survives those situations. We have been at war on this planet for so freaking long that we have enemies that we shouldn't have. All because of bankers trying to do one thing or the other. So we got to repair cultural relationships. We have to find polite ways to tell people, you know, sorry, your religion doesn't work here. It's not going to exist in this country ever. All right. And we look forward to the day when your religion disappears. You're, you know, castrating women and all that crazy Sharia law stuff. We cannot afford to go back 10, 20,000 years in the codex of how man operates, because that's primitive jungle crap. All right. All right. So we've got to be the bigger people. We got to figure out peaceful means. We can't create more enemies trying to get rid of these classic ways of doing things for those individuals. That's going to take some work. It's going to be tough, but we have to do it. So anytime we want to affect a sociological change to the world, anyone who with any brains will tell you it's got to be a psychological change first. Then once we have one thing figured out in our life, not everything figured in our life, we can start to have the conversation with other folks. You may have a conversation in order to get over that psychological issue. Look, man, I'm trying to stop doing this. What do you think I should, you know, how can I think about this? I'm going to tell you something a friend told me yesterday that utterly blew my mind. And I'll leave you with this because I think it's an awesome little reward for getting to the end of this episode. This is not my thinking. Some of you may know where this actually comes from. She told me that, because we were talking about the cyclical problem of bad habits of parents onto their children, and then they do it to their children. And the subject came up of abuse, an abusive parent that physically abuses the child. Doesn't always have to be that particular issue, but that's just, this is where you're going to understand this more than ever. And then I'll give you one of my own examples, and then we'll close it out. It's not violent. The theory goes that when you are being beat by your parent, you are the loser and they are the winner. And when you get older, you may find yourself beating your own child in order to be the winner. And you know this happens with a string of boys. If a family has, say, three boys, and the parents have done a bang-up job raising these kids, right? The older son beats up the middle son. Then the middle son beats up the younger son. And it's because they are transferring the notion of winning down to the next generation. Now I'm the winner, you're the loser. And then the next kid makes himself the winner, and someone else is the loser. Now, as soon as you understand that mechanism, which is so beautiful and so simple, you can apply this to anything that you have habitually inherited from someone else, like your parent. Now, I've said several times on the show, the one thing that really has bothered me in my lifetime, which I've learned to deal with as I got older, was that the thing that, because I'm really a relaxed, cool dude. I mean, you know, like cool as in just, I don't get terribly excited unless I'm having fun, right? I'm having fun, I'm crazy. But the thing that makes me angry is when someone betrays either me personally, which I can deal with that a little bit easier depending on what kind of betrayal it is, but definitely betraying the team. Like if I run a company, I run a group of people, and someone is deliberately slacking off when they have plenty of energy and life is good for them, they're just being a jerk. And, you know, you give everyone a little second chance. You know, you're kind of going, hey, dude, what's going on? You're late for work again. Everyone's having to make up for you. You're delaying the entire project. Da, 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 da. I'm going to give you a really short second chance. Not a big one. I'm going to give you a short one. So for the next 72 hours, I need to see that change immediately, starting tomorrow. You got issues. You need to tell me now. Forever hold your peace, right? But at times, I have seen people in friendships and professional situations continue to screw the team just because they're that kind of person, you know? And in the past, what I would do is, because I was raised by a military dad who was fairly, you know, he's very cool, but man, when he thought you were screwing around and you were doing something wrong and you knew better, it was my father. The way I would describe it today, whether he recognizes this today or not, I don't know, or especially if he recognized it back then, was his thing. And you've heard this probably in your lifetime, which is someone says, I raised you better than that, right? I taught you what was right and what was wrong. And you're acting like I didn't do that. You're acting like I, you know, that somehow you can get away with this because someone never told you how to do it right. I guarantee you, I taught you how to do it right. And so he, you know, beat my ass, right? Nothing serious. I think the last time he even put his hand on me once was like, I was 14 or 15 years old, and he was wrong and he apologized. It was kind of funny. But I took that into my world, and I would really react when I was younger. And usually when I'm working at a corporation, I definitely don't do that, even in my own company. But, you know, I've told you several stories during the show where people were screwing the team. And, man, I would just absolutely unload on these people, man. And, you know, it did, in some cases, definitely permanently fix the problem because we all kind of hugged it out afterwards. But in some cases, it definitely did not help anything. And the people just... In order to get away from their bad performance, would exit the program in a way that permanently hurt everyone who was involved. And then as I matured and grew up, I thought, geez, you know, there was a way for me to communicate in every situation where I lost my cool. There was probably a way to get across the same exact thing with a sternness and with the same level of, you know, communicated disappointment without losing my cool, getting my heart rate up really bad. And so, you know, after my friend told me that, I thought, you know, I'm going to use that every single time I feel like I might be losing my normal control. I don't have to be the winner ever, but I can still win I could maybe even make it a win for both of us by taking a step back, doing what my British mentors did in the 90s. Think about it before you talk. Play a few scenarios out. I'm always telling you that I practice what I say if I have a big speech or lecture or something like that. So anyway, maybe that's an analogy or a mechanism that you can use at some point in your life. I just wanted to pass that on because I was standing in my kitchen last night, just my brain was like, oh my God, that's a really cool thing. And now I finally understand, because I could never understand fully why the kids that get beat their kids. Because I would think that the logical thing would be, because I know plenty of people that followed the opposite route that I'm about to explain, but they would never touch their kids because they were abused. In fact, some of them were almost ridiculously incapable of raising their children because their children needed a little bit of discipline, nothing major, but they were unwilling to be a disciplinary parent because they just didn't want to walk in their parents' footsteps under any circumstance. And sadly, every child needs to be raised, you know? So here's your quiz for the end of the episode for the comment section. Tell me what you think your definition of being an adult is. Because I asked my friends, and even though we were able to talk for an hour to 2 hours apiece in each one of my conversations, and we were able to identify several touch points, for the first 5 to 10 minutes, everyone was like, geez, man, I'm not exactly sure what that is. And what's sad about that for all of us is that there isn't an immediate answer that is sort of all-inclusive, right? Almost as if there's no cliche for being an adult. There should. You know, cliches are things we're tired of hearing, but usually they have an amazing empirical level of knowledge built into them, right? This world needs to grow up. And I don't know which regions of the world might have that in ample supply, but I would say the United States of America is not one of those places. We're just too Hollywood and Botoxed out to know what it's like to get older, appreciate the phases of life, look forward to them instead of trying to spend money to never have them occur. And I'm just going to put a button on this. The one thing I want the men to understand, this is just from one guy to another guy, because I've heard, you know, one of my girlfriends once said, she goes, she says, you know, it's really hard being a woman in this day and age and getting older. And I said, well, okay, I believe you, but please itemize that for me a little bit. And she goes, well, women don't age as well as men. And so we are told by society, and society tells us back, that we are supposed to look young and beautiful for as long as we possibly can. And she said, you know, when you hit your 40s, that becomes a very slippery slope to achieve. And so every day we get older, we get more self-conscious and more, you know, sad with this goal that we can't reach. And so and I know that plenty of men out there understand this even better than I do. We have to cherish our women. And, you know, I know a lot of you guys absolutely do. Like, I like older women more than I like younger women, period. But it's usually because they're way more mature and I'm all about the brain more than anything else. But, you know, I've got friends of mine who are female who will send me, you know, pictures of their family hanging out. And every once in a while, the family will be at the beach. And so my friends are in their bikinis. Okay. And they're my age. But they'll send me a photograph and they will have, you know, changes in their body due to having children. And they'll always apologize in the photograph or after the photograph. Well, you know, sorry, my tummy's showing, you know, and I got the stretch marks or whatever. And I did have 3 kids and all that kind of thing. And it breaks my heart because in my mind, I'm like, I always say back, hey, you took one for society, right? You brought amazing kids into this world. You did a great job raising them. Those are Those are sort of trophy marks. They're not something that makes you less than someone else. The amount of wisdom you gained by having those little stretch marks here and there, whatever, you know, quote unquote damage you think you have, I don't view it that way. I know people that never had kids that are 150 pounds overweight. I have more disdain for that than I do someone who just incurred something because they brought life into this world. So one of the things that us men have to start telling our women in this world, regardless if they're your girlfriend or just a friend, is that those aren't bad things. Those are good things. That's one thing that I think men in America have to grow up and start communicating. And there's plenty of husbands out there that do it. There's plenty of husbands. I got a couple that I know in Kansas that they're both in their 50s. And she had four kids, four amazing children. And she would say certain things like this, but her husband will walk up behind her and grab her and hug her like they're 18 years old, both of them. He loves her today, probably more than when they first got married. And I'm pretty sure when they first got married, this guy was a giddy nerd loving his wife. So I see it happen. It happens more in the Midwest, I will say, in the United States than it does on the coast. Let's see what we can do about sort of upgrading the maturity of men in that particular area. Okay, I'm done with all that talk. Anyway, if you haven't been to deepthoughtsradio.com, please go. I'm going to make it short today. We have a couple video links. We have plenty of podcast links, four social media links, a couple ways to donate. We got a store with some shirts. We have an all new remastered season one on a different channel. You won't find the first 100 episodes on this channel. So go up there and subscribe. Until next time, take care of yourself and someone else. And I will see you in the next Deep Thoughts. Over now.